Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Welcome again here on Circles of Change, and always a special segment when I can have a guest come in the studio with me. Louise Serpa, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to have Louise here. She's often called the Ansel Adams of rodeo. She's been taking black and white photographs of rodeo images from every angle for now over 40 years, inside and, interestingly enough, outside the ring. And as you're going to learn tonight, today, her repertoire expands way beyond rodeo in the West and Southwest to other equestrian venues, portraits, landscapes, and other human interest subjects. She views her camera as the passport to the world and, in fact, came in with one today and has already been snapping shots here in the studio. Louise was born into high society in New York City in 1925, but it was a trip to Nevada when she was a child that made a lasting impression. And while studying music at Vassar, she often interrupted her studies to watch rodeos at Madison Square Garden. After graduation, she followed the sun to Nevada, married a local cowboy, Gordon Tex Serpa, and has two daughters. She and the girls moved to Tucson in 1960, and at that point, Louise turned her hobby into a career of taking photographs of cowboys competing in local rodeos. And although she never trained professionally as a photographer, her shutter skills and a natural instinct for anticipating the action quickly gained her entry into the professional arena. Louise is the first woman allowed to photograph in the pro rodeo area, and she's been on the course of the Grand National Steeplechase in England, and she was also, from a long list of credentials and accolades, she was inducted into the Cowgirl Hall of Fame in 1999 and was awarded the Tad Lucas Medal in 2002 from the Rodeo Historical Society at the Cowboy Hall of Fame in Oklahoma City. And she just told me before we came on the air that she actually went up to Phoenix in the 1950s to do radio, so I have a hunch I got a real pro in front of me here.
I just love radio, and in fact, you're from Connecticut originally.
That's right.
I had a show on, I can't remember the name of the station, but in Sanford for about a year and a half, I guess, with my quartet, and we had a foul. I loved it.
I loved it. In fact, she was joking this morning as she walked in, you know, she said, "Oh my gosh, I forgot that I need to do my hair today." And then she realized, oh, but I'm coming on radio, so we can have bad hair days, right, Louise?
Much, much better, much easier all the way around.
Well, tell us about that first time that you had that camera in your hand and went into the rodeo.
You mean when I first came west?
Yes.
With my mother to get her divorce from my father in 1935. Mm-hmm. That's a while ago. And we came out by train, which was a very... That was basically the only way to travel in those days. She had tested me out in a small plane flying over New York to make sure that I wasn't going to die if I got off the ground that high. And then, so we flew back from the West. But in those days, you had to go to Nevada for 6 weeks, and there was no messing around. You had to be there and establish, quote, residency, unquote. And fortunately, Mother, because she was a little devoid of huge cash, got us into a tiny little divorce ranch in Virginia City instead of being chic and going down in the valley near Reno or Carson mm-hmm. City. It was heaven. Oh, I could get dirty when I wanted to get dirty, which is all the time, having been raised in New York with white glove kind of a... bringing up.
Yeah.
I built, you know, mud adobe
homes,
bridges over little irrigation tributaries. I took a chicken house and made a playhouse out of it. I rode every chance I got. In those days, you could walk down a wash and pick up chunks of crystal. I mean, it was just heaven to anybody who had been brought up under the thumb, as I had been in New York. And right then, I thought, this is where I belong. I would love to go someday. Maybe I can get out here. I also went to my first rodeo in Reno on our way in, And as I remember, even a man was killed. And I was, you know, extraordinarily impressed by that, obviously. But it, the lure of the West. And then we did go over to Lake Tahoe, to California, after her 6 weeks residency was done. And went up the King's Highway, I think, probably. And there was not a house to be seen, if you can believe that. This is 1935. It was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life, Lake Tahoe then. And then we flew over from Reno to San Francisco, and I couldn't believe that either, with, you know, huge eucalyptus trees. That, sure. Again, it's the trees and nature, I think, I remember, more than buildings and people.
But you know, you hear that, you feel those seeds that were planted in your days and youth, and you returned and eventually,
absolutely,
you know,
yeah,
studied music, but yet snuck away, as I said in the introduction to Madison Square Garden.
No, what I snuck away. I played hooky night after night, 3 weeks in the fall. The only reason I got away with that was we'll back up a little bit, because what really got me into the West was going with a friend of mine. From Garrison Forest School, where I went to boarding school. Escape, again. Wonderful. I loved it. But Bobby Eaton, this friend of mine, had a godfather who owned Valley Ranch at that point in Colorado, and it was the beginning of the war. And Larry could not get help, either in the kitchen or, you know, as far as riding goes. I did know how to ride pretty well. So I could be a cross blessing. I washed johns and I waited on tables and I also wrangled dudes. And that was in the most gorgeous part of the Shoshone Valley in Wyoming. And the other thing that happened there was that I met a very old 17-year-old named Lex Conley, who was an escapee from Philadelphia, actually. And he was working his way that summer, just as I was. And that was my first love. And so that had a great impression on me.
Sure.
And then I got to Vassar. Lex went in the Marines, and I went to Vassar right from there, practically. And to discover that the rodeo, and Lex had indicated that maybe he wanted to go into rodeo, yes, later, and I said, that's the biggest waste of time I have ever heard. You've got a good mind, use it, and, you know, go on to your English writing career or whatever you were going to do at that point. Plus, he played polo. It did not fit in with my idea of his future. He paid no attention, of course, at all, and proceeded to send messages to his buddies that had gone to the garden. And in those days, rodeo came east and went to the garden for 3 weeks in October, I think it was, then on to Boston for 2 weeks, then to Chicago, and then to, that would have been the end of the year, then they opened again in Denver. And then Tucson,
sure,
you know, was
definitely
not too long after that. So this is, and that was the only circuit they had. Everybody went on that. So when his friends came to New York, it happened that I would just get on a train. And you know what? I can't remember to this day how I got to the train from Arlington and to Poughkeepsie. All I know is that I went down, did my homework on the train, spent about 3 hours seeing his friends and riding through the chutes, and then would get back on a train. And get back up to college probably around 12 midnight.
So nobody even knew.
No. Oh, yeah, but my night watchman, whose name was Mr. Taney, I don't know why I remember his name, he came from Wyoming, and he would let me get away with it night after night if I brought him the day sheet from that particular rodeo.
So was it this time then you started carrying a camera with you?
So when did what?
Were you taking a camera with you at that point then? Or
oh,
when did
no,
the
com-
when
I
did
the com- about a camera.
When did the camera connection come?
Not until, Lord, I'd say 1960, no, before that, in the 50s in Nevada, when Gordon Serpa my children's father and I were living there. And any time there was a roping in the valley, I would go out with my little Argus C3, you know, $27 drugstore variety camera, and take pictures of calf roping more than team roping, even so that the guys could see how their horses were setting up and what they were doing wrong. And they would pay for the... I knew rodeo because of Lex and my induction that way.
Right.
Immersion is the word more, I think. They would pay for my film and, you know, learn from these. It wasn't how great I am kind of a picture.
Sure.
It was, look what I'm doing wrong, and so mm-hmm. I can write it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my introduction to it a little bit. Then years later, when Gordon and I were divorced and I moved down here with the children, I had, you know, been to lots of rodeos. I knew the timing. I knew where to be in the arena, and that is a good part of any sports, photography, knowing your subject that well. And so I went to a junior rodeo with friends of mine that had three children riding. I'd never even known there was such a thing as a junior rodeo. And nobody was taking pictures of these glorious kids, age five, coming out on calves and doing things like that. So I thought, okay, if I don't get in the way, if they would let me in the arena, I will take pictures of these children. And then I went to the secretary, who I had schmoozed up ahead of time, and said, is that Johnny Jones, and what's his address? And sent him a postcard, or sent his family a postcard. And would you like to pick a copy of this for, you know, I think it was 75 cents a piece, or 5 by 7 at that point, all of which was done at Cable's camera here. I didn't know diddly about developing film. But ready?
That's right. You got it. And of course, what parent would not turn away?
Well, uncles, cousins, everybody else. I hit a gold mine in junior rodeo. Then they progressed to high school rodeo, then to NIRA, which is National Intercollegiate Rodeo. And on the side, I was shooting Arizona Rodeo Association, which is a sort of amateur league. And I started, obviously, going to pro rodeos, but I didn't even think about trying to get in that kind of an arena because there was one wonderful man named Devere Helfrich. And his wife was outside the arena, always selling pictures. She always knew what was going on. And he was always inside the arena, usually with a great big box camera, can you believe? And I figured, well, as long as Helen Helfrich doesn't get in the arena, I'm not going to even try. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't fair. You didn't do that to somebody else. So when he, in 1960... I guess my first ones of Tucson and Phoenix were 61, 62, shot through the fence of pro rodeo. And then by 63, I had talked somebody into giving me a press card, I think, and Devere was out of the arena. And I asked his permission, actually, if he minded if I came in behind him, because there was nobody here. I fell into a void.
Void, mainly. Well, did it ever occur to you, I mean, again, you from that very first rodeo that you went to and saw someone get killed, that you were putting yourself at risk to be in the rodeo? I mean, you had two daughters and other responsibilities at that time, too. You don't think about that, huh?
No, you don't. I remember I was learning to fly at that point, too, and they were saying, you can't do that. You're the mother of two.
And we know where that's going. If you tell Louise you can't do something, that's for sure mean you're going to
do it. No, it's not a question of a challenge, because I have already done what I wanted to do or tried to. Then I'm told no. Then I get my dander up and go ahead and do it anyway. But it was, again, involved with rodeo when I was flying a Cessna 150. I don't think they make those Tinker toys anymore. And a man named Lloyd Hawkins was stocking all the, providing the stock for the rodeos around here, the Arizona Rodeo Association rodeos. And he also had a construction company, and he had ditches on either side of Freeway Airport, which hasn't existed for quite a while. It was out on Prince and the freeway. Wonderful, wonderful. One-way, literally, airport. And he took off at 10 o'clock in the morning going one direction, because that's what the sock told you to do.
Right.
And by gum, everything changed at 10 o'clock in the morning. It was going the other direction the wind was by the time you came back, so you had to land inside.
Don't you love it? Louise, the idea of being, so you really grew with how rodeo changed, too, over the years, right? I mean, the amount of training or the differences in the animal. Can you share some of the environmental changes that have played over the years?
It's changed totally, really. I mean, it was wild and fun and sort of romantic, and it was all, you know, new, so new to me at that point, and people like Benny Reynolds and all the big guys were riding, and I knew them all, stayed at the same motels they did.
Sure.
We all played all night, literally, and then got up and performed the next day. Both of, you know, I performed
as a photographer,
and they were there. And there was a fun, there was challenge, it was a wild way of living a life where you didn't have to grow up, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden people started to get a little bit more serious and realized that you had to train. You can't just go out and drink all night and then get out the next day. And if you hurt a lot, then you just have one more, you know, brandy at night. And they were all also the circuit. Was the whole rodeo circuit was tiny. There was a rodeo somewhere in the United States every weekend, but now there are probably 20 rodeos, accredited rodeos somewhere on any given weekend, and they overlap like crazy. The guys fly between one rodeo and another to compete. And if they draw upright, because everything is drawn out of a hat, you know, or the computer.
Sure, right.
Ahead of time, so that if you draw your bareback horse at a certain performance in, say, Cheyenne, and then you have to go to another rodeo that is in within flying distance or quick driving distance, you pray that you draw up at another performance in
That's
the evening
right.
or whatever.
Exactly, you can do it.
And with luck, you can work 5 rodeos a weekend.
Oh, my goodness.
Like Cowboy Christmas. So
there you go, Cowboy Christmas, I say. And get
That's
paid for doing
call it.
That's
literally.
Right. Louise, along that line, so the days then of driving between the rodeos, the caravans, the trucks, the overnighting, you had told me once when we first met about there's nothing more glorious for you than to be on the road by yourself. Driving with your camera. Tell us
just,
that.
There's so many times that I have driven to a rodeo and you had to get there on time, or to a horse show, or to a cutting horse competition. You have to be there on time and you have to do your job, and then I had to turn around and go home, you know, so that I didn't get a chance to really see where it was I went.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last, in the 90s, I guess I started just driving north to Montana, which I had never had a chance to see, with a book on tape and just take off. And if I didn't want anybody else in the car with me, because then I could see a road and I wanted to go down, and I would just do it without having to say, do you mind if?
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
That's a vicarious way of driving to me. It's just heaven.
And I'm sure that with that heaven came optimum opportunities for you to snap photos, right?
Yeah, that's why I did it.
Yeah.
And I went places that I had never had time to go while I was on the road. And I did that a lot abroad. I tried to make one trip, a work trip, abroad every year. And all through the 70s, I worked in England every summer, all starting with the fact that I had shot the Grand National for, I was the first woman allowed on course, in a dress, I might add,
because
the Queen was there, and you didn't ever go anywhere that the Queen was if you weren't dressed appropriately. Even a mile and a half out on the grounds where she couldn't see you.
No kidding. That's right.
But that was, then after the Grand National was over, I went to stay with new friends in England and in Ireland, and you know, it was the thing to do to bring a house present. Well, I didn't have any big bucks at that point, so the only thing I could do to or think of to do was to take pictures of their grandchildren and their ducks and their chickens and their cats
sure,
everything around and send them for thank you very much. So the next year I went, all their neighbors had their ducks, their chickens, their grandchildren out ready for me to take pictures of them. So it was a byproduct.
I love it. And so, as you said, we said that the camera is the passport. And just the collection of people. I know when Ted and I had an opportunity to visit your home, the photo albums you have, the portraits, the even pictures of hands.
I love
inquisitiveness. Why hands?
There hasn't been time enough. That's the trouble. And here I'm about to cruise into my 50th year. Can you believe this will be my 50th rodeo?
Rodeo
in
coming
Tucson.
Up. 50th rodeo.
Coming. There are so many things that I started that I haven't had time to finish. A series of hands-on, and I've got the people welding. I've got all kinds. I've got DeGrazia. And Ted DeGrazia had the most gorgeous hands I think I've ever seen of anybody. But again, I just have got collections started and never had time to go back and do the things that I really wanted to do. And it's getting a little late now.
But the idea of hands, because there's so much of our story that's there, isn't there?
Right.
And whether it's they be the bumps, it's tactile, it's what we've touched.
Right.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that first camera that you got, and I know you have a little digital one here in the studio, but I know you really like working with the real silver
cameras.
Analog cameras.
Except they're so darn heavy, I'd forgotten how much I was lugging around all those years. But I also like the fact that I can get in the darkroom and take the negatives and make them better. You can shoot a picture badly, and you can make or break it in the darkroom, actually, if you work at it. Over the years, I learned a lot about that part.
And so in the idea that you could be part of your craft, not just from what you're seeing visually, but then that visual portrayal to everyone.
Exactly. And I miss that part. I really do. But it's... I guess if I'm around long enough, I'll learn to like digital, but I doubt it.
You know, the idea that earlier I said, I was very careful this time because I know my husband facilitated a chance for you to speak in front of a group, and he said that you grew up in New York, to which you just went running and said, no, I've never grown up, and it certainly wasn't New York. Share with our listeners that concept of growing up.
I didn't. I mean, I just, it was all sort of choked down inside. I could never get dirty. I had to be at as I fondly call it, Miss Chapin's School for Small Girl Snobs, which is not fair. The school is absolutely wonderful. And Mother was wonderful to send me there. It was the best education I could have gotten at that particular point. But I hated it. I hated my life in New York.
So the idea that you could follow that sunshine, the come west, the rodeo.
Well, when I finally busted loose, people kept saying, oh, you've got such courage. How can you possibly get in a car and drive west without knowing where you're going? That doesn't take courage. It takes courage to do something you don't want to do, to me.
That's absolutely.
And I just got in my six-cylinder Dodge with my huge dog and headed west and ended up working in a dress shop in Scottsdale, so you never know what you're going to do.
That's right. Well, Louise Serpa, thank you so very much for joining us today in Circles of Change. It's an important show, 250th for us, but also to recognize the contributions you make to your art, to other people you inspire, and you make us laugh. So thanks again for being on our show.
Thank you.
You bet.
For having
me. A pleasure. Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, 877-544-2580.